WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the daughter of a Chicago policeman who was shot on the job, Gina Gallo thought that being a cop was a loser's game. The job had made him emotionally detached to the point of coldness. She became a psychotherapist and worked at a state facility. But after budget cuts threatened her job, and she was a divorced mother of two, she figured out she'd make more money and get better benefits as a cop. She joined the Chicago police with the intention of working in the counseling center, but she ended up on inner-city streets. When she became a cop in 1982, many of the men on the force had trouble accepting women. Even some of the women felt safer with a male partner. Not Gallo. For several years, she had a woman partner. Gallo stayed on the force until 1998 and now writes stories based on her experiences. Her new book is a memoir called Armed and Dangerous. I asked her what her father thought of her becoming a cop.
He thought that I was out of my mind. He said there was no way in the world that I would last. He said, I'll give you 5 minutes and you're going to run screaming out the door because you are not cop material.
He was wrong, huh?
I still don't know what cop material is. This many years later, after all I've seen and done and all the people that I've interacted with, I really don't know if there is a definition for that term, cop material.
You recount in your book a situation in which you and your partner, Diane, showed up at a spouse abuse call. And she saved your life in that. A guy was ready to shoot you. Would you describe what happened?
We got a call of a man with a gun, and when we got to the house, she went around the back of the house, and I went through the front.
Your partner went around the back.
Diane went around the back. We had called for backup, but it was very busy that night, so we didn't anticipate that anybody would be showing up anytime soon. There was only one rear entrance, and she knew that he was going to come out that entrance. But there was no place else to hide in the yard, so what she did was she climbed up on the garage roof. And she thought that if he came out the back door, he would certainly turn. When he saw that no one was in the yard, he would certainly turn and attempt to kill me, which is exactly what he did. So she just jumped off the garage roof and jumped on top of him. She just leaped on him, and she ended up smashing her knee, breaking her kneecap. But she did save my life, and that was the first night that we worked together.
How soon did she get back on the job after breaking her kneecap?
She was gone for about 6 months.
And then you became partners again?
We became partners and we worked together for a number of years, yes.
I want you to describe the episode that ended your partner Diane's career as a cop.
We got a call of a domestic disturbance in the projects. These are high-rise projects, 15 floors. And when we got there, it was a man and his wife, and he had come home drunk, and they got into an argument. And she said she was calling the police. She wanted him out of the house. So they started to physically fight. When Diane and I got there, she wanted us to lock him up. She said she would sign complaints, but she definitely wanted him taken away, which is something that is often said in a domestic disturbance. The woman will generally say, and this is, I think, a power move on her part. She'll say that, yes, I want him locked up. I'll sign complaints. I am the one who's been maligned. I am the victim. Give me the complaints, I'll sign them, but take him to jail. And there's nothing that the man can do except be arrested, go to jail. Except that in a great number of these situations, when after the complaints have been signed and you go to arrest the man, the woman changes her mind and suddenly the police are the enemy. And she'll fight the police because they're trying to take her man, which is what happened. She started to fight with me. While this was happening, her husband, who had a gun in his waistband, and we didn't know this at the time, dropped the gun. Diane had to wrestle him for the gun. They were involved in a fight in the apartment over the gun. I ended up rolling out on the balcony with this woman, and everyone that lived on that floor heard the commotion, came out of their apartments and saw that there was a cop down on the floor wrestling around, and they all came over and they decided to fight too. And it was me they were fighting and kicking and stomping. While my partner was wrestling with a man with a gun alone in the apartment, I heard gunshots, I heard several gunshots, and then I heard police coming up the stairs, and I was starting to pass out. I don't remember anything else. What had happened was Diane had gotten shot in the hand. The man had gotten shot in the thigh during the struggle. His shot was minor. Her injuries were severe enough that she had to leave the job on a permanent disability.
What was it like for you to go back to work after your partner was disabled and after you were beaten to the point of unconsciousness?
Surprisingly, being beaten to the point of unconsciousness was not the issue, because part of what you go through on the job trains you to expect that. That's just considered occupational hazard, and so it's not something that you really concern yourself with one way or the other. You get, if you're a police officer and you're doing your job, you're going to get injured eventually, and usually regularly. So that was not the issue, but going back to work and knowing that I wouldn't be with her was like not having one of my limbs, or working, being expected to work without a gun. I didn't have the backup. I didn't have the emotional commitment. I didn't have that whole set of communications that you develop over a long term with someone that you really trust. And I had to start all over again with someone else. It was very, very difficult.
Did your children want you to return to the force after you were injured and your partner was disabled?
I had some issues with my children. They were in grammar school. They were early years of grammar school at that time. And one of my sons had started having nightmares because he had gotten so used to seeing me come home bloody, blood on my uniform, or injured, or having to have stitches or crutches or a cast. And I was the only parent. It was a single parent family. And he started having nightmares that something would happen to me where I would never come home again.
You'd been through this kind of thing as a child when your father was a cop. What did you do to try to console your child?
There's not a lot you can do when they see you strapping on the gun belt every night to go out and do it again. And I could not legitimately say to them, don't worry, I'm going to be fine, I'll be back again, because you don't know that. And they don't know that, and so you have to give them the truth, which is, I'll be careful, and I'll do the best I can, and we all have to be strong together. And that's really the best that you can give them.
My guest is Gina Gallo. Her new memoir, Armed and Dangerous, is about her experiences as a Chicago cop from 1982 to 98. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gina Gallo, and she's written a new memoir about her 16 years on the Chicago police force. It's called Armed and Dangerous. What can you tell us about the call that ended your career as a cop?
There had been some police officers killed that afternoon. I was working midnights, and it had followed this killing of these two officers on the previous afternoon had followed a number of incidents where other police officers had been gunned down in the street. And so the emotional climate within the department among the ranks was very, very tense, because the word on the street was among the gang population in Chicago, which is extremely high, was that if you kill the cop, you are considered at a very high status within the gang hierarchy. So it almost became like a status symbol to be able to say that, yes, I killed a cop, and look, I have his gun. And I used his gun after I killed him to go out and commit another crime. When I went to work that night, everyone was tense. These two officers had been killed that afternoon. When we sat in roll call that night, our watch commander told us that, well, they're out there and they want our blood and they're gunning for us, so be careful and do what you have to do to protect yourself. I was working with a rookie that night. He had just gotten out of off probation. He had been on the street only a matter of weeks, and he wanted to work with me because my regular beat was one that was in the projects in the inner city, And I regularly got a high number of gun and narcotic arrests. So for a rookie coming out of the academy, this is very exciting. These are the felony arrests that they want to get into because it's something that they see on TV. So they think if they get into it right away, you know, they're going to be like all the guys on NYPD Blue. So he requested to work with me. I wasn't familiar with this guy. I didn't know anything about him. Other than that, he had just gotten off probation. So we began our tour of duty. It was very, very cold that night. It was in January. And it was relatively uneventful, and I was really happy about that because I hadn't seen him work and I didn't know how he would perform. We got a call of a domestic disturbance at about 2 or 3 in the morning. And when we got there, it was a second-story apartment. And the mother was telling us that her son was the problem and that he was running around with gangbangers and was using a lot of drugs. And he was bringing them into her house, and she didn't want them there. And she wanted us to do something about it. The son wasn't on the premises at that time, she said. It was actually a one-room apartment like a studio. And the only thing that we could see was a bed and a sink and a closet area that had a curtain over the closet. She said that he had gone out with his friends, but he was expected back in several hours. But she just wanted to know what her rights were when he came back, if he should happen to come back with his gangster friends. Did she have the right to put them out of the house? Did she have a right to use a weapon, or should she just call the police? While we were talking to her about this, my partner was standing across the room. I was facing her, and the son, who was hidden in the closet, jumped out with a bat in his hand and started to beat me with the bat. The first blow went to the head. It knocked me down, and he was beating me with the bat while my partner stood and watched. My partner is the one who had the radio. He could have radioed for help, and he didn't. He froze. He was terrified. He did nothing. He didn't pull a weapon. He didn't use any intervention at all. And when I started screaming and told him to shoot him, he ran out of the house.
Were you injured badly?
I was seriously enough where I passed out. There was a skull fracture and a number of other things, but I was passing out, and the son dropped the bat and decided that if the partner had run out, then maybe he was going for backup and would bring more police. So he started to leave, but then he realized that I was a cop. I had a gun. So he came back to get it. And because I had curled into a fetal position and was laying on the floor, I had broken ribs and a broken collarbone as well. He kicked me to try and turn me over so he could find the gun. And when he did that, it made me open my eyes, and I shot at him.
Did you hit him?
I hit him, but I didn't hit him, his body. It went through. He was wearing a leather jacket. It went through his jacket, through his sleeve. But when I shot, he stumbled backward, and he ran out of the building. And I tried to get up, and I crawled after him. And because it was on the second floor, I fell down that flight of stairs, landed at the bottom of the stairs, and laid there for an unknown amount of time until my field sergeant happened to be driving by, saw the squad car and no one in it, and then came closer to see what was going on and saw my body at the bottom of the stairs.
What happened to your partner who abandoned you?
My partner had run. They found him several blocks away hiding, and I was taken to the hospital immediately to ER. They brought him. They had another patrol car bring him to the hospital to take his report. He was terrified. It was his first situation where there had been any kind of incident of violence on the street, and he just froze.
Is he still a cop?
Yes.
So this is the incident that ended your career because of your injuries. After that was over, when you realized you weren't going back to work as a cop ever again, did you have any regrets about having been a cop?
There weren't any. After those injuries and after I was out of the hospital and after an extensive amount of physical therapy, that actually did not end the career at that time from that incident. They actually had me working inside in a limited duty capacity, which means that you work in a clerical position, but you don't ever work on the street again.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for several years, but the initial injuries that I had sustained were so debilitating that there continued to be deterioration. So finally, it got to a point where there was some degree of paralysis, and finally the department said, you are not capable of carrying on even these duties in limited capacity, so you have to take a duty disability. And I don't have any regrets about the job. The regrets that I have are the way that it changed me in ways that almost mimic my father, that I didn't expect and didn't anticipate and didn't recognize until afterward.
Like what?
My perspective of people now is much more skeptical, much more doubtful of the validity of what they're saying to me. I have a tendency not to believe people. I have a tendency to question what their true agenda is and whether or not there's a scam. It changes the way I sit in a restaurant with my back to the wall, or the way I see people in a position where they work with children, and I wonder about what their true motives are. Are they really motivated to work with kids because they like them, or do they have other less noble motivations? From the things that I've seen on the street, it's colored how I view people as a whole, and it's not always in the most positive light.
Do you still carry a gun?
Yes.
How come?
Because I just don't know what's out there, and I need to be ready.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write in your book that you were the first in your class to kill someone in the line of duty, and that after you shot him, you expected to feel guilty, but instead you felt nothing.
I waited. I had heard stories in the academy, and this is one of the things that they teach you while you're going through, is that, well, you know, they'll tell you, you can go through your entire 30-year career and never fire your weapon once. Most police do that. It's very rare to become involved in a shooting situation. And on the fourth day, I was involved in mine. I had heard from my father about his incident. He had several incidents. And he said that he had nightmares for years after that. He saw his victim's face in his dreams, asking him why he did it. And when I was involved in my shooting, the only thing I thought while I stood there watching this man's blood drain down the sidewalk, it was raining, and the blood was just kind of fading into this pastel wash. This is a man that I killed. He's dead at my hands. And the only thing I could think of was, my kids are at home waiting for me. Every night they would ask me, Mommy, what did you do today that was exciting? You know, what exciting police things did you do? And the only thing I could think was that night I would be able to say, I got to come home to you.
Did you use your gun again after that?
Yes.
Often?
No.
And did the feelings change? You know, when you shot someone afterwards?
No.
You also saw many victims of shootings. And you write, you learned what it's like to cradle the head of a gunshot victim as you try in vain to stanch the blood, knowing you're the last person he'll see and feel, and that you're the only one who will witness his passage from this life. It must be really strange to have such an intimate moment with a stranger to watch. You know, to share that moment with a stranger as he dies.
It's a very unusual situation to be in, because you have become not just the enforcer as a cop. You're not just the enforcer, but you're the protector and the caregiver. So while you're protecting the public, you're also their safeguard. You're protecting them from these evils. And if, in fact, here's a victim that you weren't able to protect, that you didn't get to in time, that you were deficient in your duties, and as a result, now they're dying, Then suddenly you revert to caretaker and caregiver again, and you hold them, and you watch them die. And not only are you thinking that this is the last person that they'll see, I am the last face that they will take with them after it's over. Not only are you thinking that, but you're also thinking, I may be the reason for this, because I didn't get here in time, because I wasn't able to help. And that's something that you carry with you. And that's one of the things that changes you and begins the change in how you relate to other people and how you think of yourself.
Well, Gina Gallo, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
Gina Gallo's new memoir about her 16 years on the Chicago police force is called Armed and Dangerous. This is Fresh Air.